So, first question. No questions? Yes, there's one over here.
It's not working. Or is it? It's for Mr. Lentini. And the question is, we had multiple points of origins, poor patterns. Did anybody ever take, I've not seen any in the writings, of hydrocarbons, presence of hydrocarbons?
There were samples collected in both cases. The Willis case had no positive laboratory results. The Willingham case, they did find some mineral spirits on the front porch, right where he kept his barbecue and his charcoal lighter fluid.
But nothing in the room.
Nothing inside.
And any other multiple points of origins, was that ever?
Well, multiple points of origin is pretty damning evidence that the fire was intentionally set. But in order to make that determination, you've got to find an area that's unburned in between two burn places. As you saw in that flashover video, the fire goes up, spreads across the ceiling, and comes back down. There's a lot of two-dimensional thinking going on in fire investigation because we're surrounded by two-dimensional surfaces that collect the patterns. And so if a guy sees burning over here on the floor and burning over there on the floor, he might say, aha, two points of origin, not thinking that there's a connection above or a connection on the wall. There was no evidence of multiple origins in either one of them, although they said there was.
Just the last part, was it ever determined what started the fire?
No.
I just wanted to add one point on the multiple point of origin. It was presented in trial, Vasquez presented multiple points of origin as a key indicator of why it was arson. When I went to investigate the case, I spoke to the other fire investigator on the case, and he actually told me he did not think there were multiple points of origin, but he said nobody had ever asked him about it, and that's why he never testified to that fact.
Hmm. Thank you. With a question over here.
Hi, Thomas Doey, Trinity University. You noted the political effect on the post-conviction review of the evidence in the Texas cases. One of the things I study is the effects of judicial and prosecutor selection, the political effects of elected prosecutors and judges. What effect do you think that has on the failure to review these post-conviction cases?
I'm sorry, what was the final thing you asked?
The fact that in most jurisdictions in the United States, prosecutors and judges have to stand for election. Very few people get reelected by saying, we made a lot of mistakes in prosecuting and convicting people. What effect do you think that has in the failure to more thoroughly review these sorts of post-conviction problems?
Well, I think it probably has a large effect. I think what a lot of people have been probably surprised about is how much political traction actually doing the right thing has. That this non-traditional role that we've taken on as prosecutors, even though it's there in every ethical code that's ever been written, that it's a prosecutor's duty to seek justice, not to simply seek convictions or simply to protect convictions, even bad convictions, that this non-traditional role we've taken on is actually has a lot of political traction. And the interest I've heard expressed from other offices, and I know Manhattan Prosecutor's Office has now started Conviction Integrity Unit, which I think is the real deal. But most of the inquiries I've gotten from other prosecutors' offices, I honestly think in many instances they were more interested in the political traction that we seem to be getting out of that than they were in actually starting something that was doing an honest and thorough review of the cases that would expose possible mistakes of the past.
It's a really interesting point. Okay, we have time for one more question.
My name is Kimberly Melman Orozco. I'm a PhD student in George Mason University's Criminology Department. And my question is, it seemed like the panelists focused on improving the investigation aspect in order to prevent this miscarriage of justice. But what degree do you think that improving the standard of indigent defense would have helped, I guess, forego what had happened in this case that you had mentioned.
Anybody like to take that? Mike?
You know, I had a list of things that I anecdotally had concluded were factors, common factors in the proven wrongful convictions in the 20 DNA and in other cases out of Dallas County, which is also consistent with what all the literature I've ever read is on people who actually do serious studies, scientific studies on the causes. And, you know, in some cases, I think improving the quality of indigent defense, because what I think every one of these exonerees had in common is every one of them was indigent. And certainly improving the standards of indigent defense and improving the actual indigent defense would be helpful, because that was one of the factors that I believe went into some of the wrongful convictions. But some of these guys, and one case I didn't talk about, some of them had really competent defense lawyers, who did a good job. But it evidently, in some cases, it just didn't matter. So there are a number of factors that go into them, but I think certainly improving the quality of indigent defense would be one of the things that would improve the system and prevent these kind of travesties.
Thank you, Mike. I think our time is up, but I want to say thank you so much to all of our panelists for sharing their knowledge with us about what I think is one of the most fascinating cases that I have ever read about. And I think the lessons that we've learned about this case will continue to inform us and to improve our work in the criminal justice system for many, many years to come. So thank you all.